Hi, Pete.
Hi, Sergio. Nice to see you again.
Yeah, same here. So you're have a long time interest in focusing and in spirituality.
Yes, I have. Yes. Yeah, it's probably been going on for many decades, actually, because the issue that interested both my colleague and myself, because I worked together with another priest, Father Ed McMahon, is what is the body's role in spiritual development? That was the bottom line question that we were trying to understand better and to see what we could learn about that so that in issues of pastoral care and even scripture studies and all kinds of things like that, we could incorporate the body's role in whatever it is that religion does that brings any kind of wholeness into our lives. And
Yeah.
so that's just kind of a little bit of an overview. And there's one thing that is a bit humorous, but I would want to mention that one of the things that I learned most, I didn't learn from books. I didn't learn from religion people. I learned it because for 3 or 4 years, I was a beekeeper.
A beekeeper.
A beekeeper. And I have to honestly say, I have learned more about spirituality bees than I have of many, many tomes and books that I've read. And it was a remarkable experience for me, which I can share with you.
Well, after talking about it this way, it's impossible not to.
Okay, well, the first thing I noticed, because I'd never done anything like beekeeping, and the first thing I noticed when I put on my, hat and everything was that each colony has its own personality. Some of them are very fierce, and you can't get anywhere near the hive. And with the others, they're just kind of curious. They kind of buzz around you, but they're not aggressive or anything like that. And so that was the first thing that I noticed. But the most essential thing, vis-a-vis our discussion today, I learned, and it didn't take long for me to learn it, and that is, if you've ever seen a colony of bees when they're swarming, and you have this big ball of bees hanging from a branch in a tree, the thing that I learned was that that entire ball in and of itself is a single living organism. There isn't a bee in that bundle that can survive overnight, apart from on a chilly night, apart from the other bees. The bees have to cluster together and in order to keep warm. And without the colony, the individuals cannot survive. So that was kind of a first lesson for me. And that what that did for me is it opened up a question. Well, if for the bees, what about us? It just kind of raised an issue for me. And so then I just began to explore that, and it just went from there. And I began to find things where there were parallels, and there were similarities between what we as a hive, as a colony, and as individuals are living through and in. And so, that was just kind of a starting point for me. It was something that I didn't expect. And yet when I started chewing into it, I realized there was a very, very significant connection. And where that led me from is that I only know the Christian religion with some depth, but I'm sure there must be parallels with other communions. But at any way, Christianity is not a Western religion. Its roots are in the Middle East. And the Middle East at the time that it began was a tribal society, and to this day still largely is tribal. And so it's in the biblical studies, there's a really interesting category that biblical scholars use. It's called corporate personality. It's not necessarily the best title, but what it means is there's an easy back and forth between the individual member of the tribe as well as the whole tribe in itself. And they just go back and forth between the two because for them, it was considered to be a single psychic whole, whether you're an individual or whether it's the entire tribe.
So, Pete, is it okay if I just repeat that phrase, a single psychic whole? A very, very powerful phrase in terms of that image of, you mentioned the image of the swarm of bees that are together and that can't survive without being together.
Exactly, yeah. And so, you know, that's the way they view themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that in many ways is different from our sense in the West of rugged individualism. We put a lot of emphasis on individuality, but we also need to have our foot on the side of solidarity. You know, this kind of closeness with one another. Mm-hmm. As a single tribe. So it's important to realize that that's what happened. And then in the biblical study in sciences, they set up an actual category, and it was called corporate personality. And that was that easy back and forth that I was mentioning between the individual and the group. Mm-hmm. So this is a very, very important thing to understand because it goes to the very roots of Christianity. And it's something that says who and what and from where this particular group comes. Mm-hmm. So I think that's important enough that people realize that we have a root system in a culture that is quite different from our Western culture.
Yeah, yeah. And so you say, where this group comes from and what, so there is a sense of groundedness in that.
Exactly.
You know, we don't have, the individual, as a self that is ungrounded.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that says something as much about the individual as it does about the society itself.
Mm-hmm.
Within which people live. And what I found really fascinating as my colleague and I began to get into an area, it's called the psychology of religion. You know, what in religion, you know, it contributes to human health and wholeness. And so part of what we were looking at is we were looking at this whole area of psychology. And there is a philosopher and psychologist. His name is Eugene Gendlin. And he has set up a program, and he put something in such clear language that I just wanted to read it to you and to the group here that we're speaking to. And he said this, he said, your physically felt body is in fact part of a gigantic system of here and other places, now and other times. You and other people, in fact, the whole universe. This sense of being bodily alive in a vast system is the body as it can be felt from inside. I think that's a really classic statement, and it's supported by William James writing in 1901 when he said God is both a causal agent as well as a medium of communion, which is a very interesting way. He wrote that in The Varieties of Religious Experience. So that he's getting at interaction. Most of us in the West, we like to analyze things into content. You know, what's the content that makes up this person?
Right.
Yeah, and here you see it's a little different because you're incorporating and bringing in interaction.
Yeah, process, yeah.
The process is telling you more, perhaps, than you ever might get or imagine that you could get out of the content. So I found that really interesting, that just that little bit of a switch of the, and you begin to realize, you know, well, there are really different perspectives here. And I think that's what is necessary and important that we understand. So, do you have any questions?
Well, so it seems like that statement, between the Gentlin statement that you wrote is the link between the experience of the bees and that sense of wanting to look for spirituality that might have a physical bodily component.
Exactly. See, the meaning is not only thought in the mind, it is also felt in the body. Mm-hmm. And Jen gave that a particular name. He called it a felt sense. It's felt because it's felt in the body. But a sense, not like the five senses, but like, she makes good sense, where sense is a meaning word. You see, and the body grasps meaning, but it grasps it in a different way than the mind analyzes and thinks. And so, I mean, you get simple examples like a youngster reaches college age and she goes off to college and then maybe 2 days later the phone starts ringing and mom picks it up. And all she has to hear are the first three words, and she knows something is wrong. Now, she knows nothing of the content. She knows nothing of what it's all about, but she just knows something is wrong. Now, we have words like intuition, inspiration, revelation, hunch. We have words like that to try to get at this sense in the body of meaning.
See how it's
something that we do automatically and we can't quite put it in the head brain, but if you want to use the phrase the body brain is picking something up. And so that's a small expression of what this is all about.
And what you're saying is it's not just a hunch about, say, how your son might be doing, but it's also about, in a way, meaning of our role, our place in the universe, you know, what life is about.
Exactly. Because it's as I said earlier, we are living in a vast system, but we can feel it from the inside. And that's where we are as a species, if you want to put it that way. I'm sure there are many, there are many more perhaps evolutionary kinds of things that can emerge from this, but we know a lot more than we think in our mind we do. And that kind of knowing is operational. And what Eugene Gentlin in focusing has done is he's brought the awareness of that over into the psychological community, and eventually it will merge into the philosophical community, And what Ed and I were finding is, well, it spills over certainly into the theological community because there are ramifications there. And it just kind of forces one to take a step back and say, you know, maybe we're kind of limited in the way that we're viewing our humanity, because we may be on the verge of maturing into a kind of awareness of one another that we might never have even imagined before. And it's something that we probably need, because when you have ethnic conflicts, when you have differences, and when you have historical, you can only call them as poisonous histories, and that's all we can think of. But, you know, we haven't been able to connect, or those people have not been able to connect with one another in another layer within their humanity. And there's a great potential there, I think, because when you're listening to someone, and I'm training someone to be, or, you know, to be a good companion using focusing, I tell them that you have to listen not only to what the person is saying, but also to how he or she is saying it, or is in the saying of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You see what I mean? You're trying to catch. Sure, they've got information that you can understand, but how is this other person in the telling of that, or in the sharing of that? And then if you can respond to that, how he or she is in it, then they feel really heard.
And
that kind of a depth. And then in anyone working in counseling or therapy, if they can just make that slight little difference between responding to the information and responding to how the speaker is in the saying about that, or the telling of that.
And so that aspect is a fundamental part of biospiritual focusing.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, and you can see the ramifications in therapy and counseling and that kind of thing.
So do you want to maybe say a few words about biospiritual counseling per se, of how you came to it, how would you, you know, talk about it?
Yeah, well, I would take a step back and just say focusing,
mm-hmm.
teaching people, because what all that Ed and I were doing is we were taking something that is, it can work extremely well in a therapeutic situation.
Mm-hmm.
And we brought it out of that because we recognized that there were spiritual implications in this. And so that it's not so much that using it in a spiritual setting is necessarily therapy.
Mm-hmm.
It's very therapeutic. But I wouldn't want to go so far as to say that it was therapy as such. But I'm sure in many instances it would be.
What I'm also hearing you say is that by the very nature of focusing, even if it's not biospiritual focusing, the nature of focusing is also to have a connection with the spiritual.
I think so. I think really it's grounded there.
Mm-hmm.
And that the image of the bees and everything, there's something in our psyche that when we can be with and in one another in that layer of listening and caring and that kind of thing, then things can really happen and cultures can change.
So maybe the point is actually that the focusing attitude, the kind of listening and caring, is actually a way of putting intentionality and living the experience of being connected in a way that the tribe is connected, or in a way that the beehive is connected.
Exactly. I mean, I couldn't say it any better than that. Yeah. Yes. And this is a possibility. This is a potential. But you see, in order to the wrinkle in the rug is, how do you teach this? How do you pass it on to the next generation? You see, and what the difficulty is you're not just teaching information. You're teaching the development of a whole new habit in your body and in your feelings. And see, that's a different breed of cat, because when you're helping someone with information, information is information, and information is good. It only goes so far, but it's good. But when you get into this other thing, then you're really reaching deeper into the humanity of the person.
Right. So it's a transmission of experience.
Exactly.
It's not a transmission of information.
Yes. Right. And that can be life saving and enhancing and everything else. So it just seems to me that in our educational system, if we can begin, even in a very small way, to begin introducing this into that, so that kids are not so afraid of their feelings, you know, and they want to run away from them. And one of the things that Jen Lynn has done, it seems to me, is he has another little category that he set up, and it's called process skipping. And process skipping is simply identified as, what do I do in order not to feel my difficult feelings?
Mm-hmm.
You see, and we, believe you me, we really have all kinds of them. And if you want to really hear who has this, go into a class of seventh graders and just ask them, what do you do in order not to feel your feelings? And they're going to be coming at you. You know, I jog, I play with my cat, I read a book, I hang out with my friends at the mall, you know. I mean, they were just like little kids shooting a whole lot of little guns off. But they're just telling you all the things that they're doing in order not to feel their difficult feelings.
Yeah.
And the sad thing is, well, where did they learn how to do this? I mean, they never know this so well. And the only answer you can give is they learned it by watching us, the big people in their lives. So, you know, there's so much in here that has a richness to it. And it also has a, it just opens up our humanity.
And again, maybe that one is, emphasize the point. This is, you're talking about that disconnection. So disconnection from feelings and disconnection from others. And so all of these things are disconnection from what is, what makes us human.
Exactly. And you know, the connections are myriad. You know, there's all kinds of connections. But the more you have, then the more your empathic abilities and things like that can become part of your daily living. And I think, you know, I think the implications of this are such that they should really be, I don't know whether you'd have to set up another track in the educational system, but it would be so helpful for so many people and for families. You know, they often get into spats about nothing. And, if you're listening in to how the other person is saying and how they are in what they are saying, even just that small little smidge of listening a little bit deeper, it just seems to clear the air, or it opens a door, or someone really hears me, is what happens.
Yeah. So that's there's a quantum leap. There's a qualitative difference there. It's entering into a different experience of life,
and it's entering into a different way of interacting.
Mm-hmm.
You see, because you see, you learn as much, if not more, about how something interacts as you do from an analysis of their contents.
Mm-hmm.
you see. And so if you can open that door, then you get a far more refined sense for how we can be with one another, how we can walk with one another. See, I always make it very clear when someone comes and they need some help in their focusing. You know, I make it very clear that I don't have any answers for your problems. But what I can do is I can walk with you as you discover your own answers. And the answers they discover for themselves are the ones they will really remember.
Right. And so maybe that's a concept of companioning.
It is. I think so. You know, you have to, if you're there to fix them, then you're just in your traditional doctor-patient relationship. And this is not a doctor-patient relationship, you know. But you're being there and you're walking with them and you are hearing not just what they are saying, but how they are in the saying of it. When you can open that door, then what happens is there's another layer in there of communication, and especially in families and especially with little ones.
So do you want to talk a little bit about that, about families and children and teens, you know?
Let me give you just a couple of simple examples. I was with a seventh grade girl, and what happened is somehow usually I'd be working with two or three kids, but something happened. We had a good number of facilitators with us, and they were working with the other kids, so I just had this one girl. And so I taught her how to focus, and we got to be kind of good friends. And then when she came to say goodbye, she said to me, "I'm really going to miss this special way we've had of talking to one another."
Mm.
And I could just feel tears when I
read it. Yeah.
It was so profound, and yet at the same time coming out of the mouth of this young girl. And another one that just really bowled me over, I'm telling you, this one I could not believe. There was a family that I knew, and they had a little toddler. And the little toddler was about, I don't know, 2.5, 3 years old, something like that. I can't tell. You know, I don't have my own toddler, so I can't really tell how the other ones were. But nonetheless, he knew me vaguely. Well, anyway, I was talking to his mother. In Sonora, there's a kindergarten, but it's a preschool get together with moms and the kids and everything else. And so I was talking to this mother, and her elder son, I guess he was 8 or 9, he came running over just screaming and crying. And, you know, she took him and held him, and he just kept crying. And finally she sat down on the floor with him, and he still was crying. And then so she looks up at me and she says, "Well, here's a real situation. What do we do?" And so first thing I did is I sat down next to the boy, and his mom, he had somehow hurt his ankle, and his mom was holding his ankle. And so I sat down and I said to him, "Do you think you could imagine making yourself really, really small and going down into your body and going all the way down into your ankle and telling your ankle how sorry you are that this has happened, and, you know, be nice to your ankle?"
Mm.
And the first thing the mom noted and told me afterwards what she said, "As soon as you asked him to go down inside, he stopped crying." Now, I don't know whether that was her issue or because it was a little embarrassing maybe, but nonetheless, he stopped, and then the mom was there with her hand on the ankle, and I put my ankle there, and we were all being nice to the ankle. Now, while this was going on, the toddler, who'd been about, you know, 15 feet away, when he heard his brother yelling and screaming, he kind of kept walking in. And then I just noticed that in the last part of when I had been talking before I put my hand down, he was really watching us carefully. And then when the three of us were sitting there on the floor and we had our hands on the boy's ankle, this little guy who walked over behind his mom and he just rolled against her back. And then he went around behind his brother and he rolled against his brother. And then I will never forget this. He came and got around me and he rolled against me and then he just leaned back and parked there. And the only thing I could think of is he knew something was happening that was good for his brother and he wanted in his own little way to be part of it. I'm sure there was something going, there had to be something going on in that little guy because he didn't know me that well. And it was just amazing to be in a situation like that and have that happen. And, you know, I just was wondering, well, what kind of experiencing does this little guy already really have?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but it's a neat story.
Yeah.
Here's another one that I think is really.
Let's go back to this one. When you're telling the kid to get that really small inside, talk to the ankle. Had you started? Was it his introduction to focusing? Had you given him anything, or was it like the way he got into it? So just essentially by directing his attention to going inside, you got him into a focusing mode.
Yeah, and I probably said something to him that nobody else had ever said to him. You know, go inside. So even the uniqueness of it might have worked that way. But nonetheless, it was I was helping him to develop a new kind of relationship to his own body.
Yeah,
and that's essentially all that I'm doing with adults and other people. I just help them to develop a whole new way of relating to their own body and their own feelings.
And to their own self.
And to their own self, exactly. The other one that was really interesting for me, because it was something that I think could be very, very supportive and useful in families. This one mom, once she learned how to focus, the first thing she wanted to do is she wanted to learn how to focus with her children. And she had little toddlers. And so we wrote up some things for them. But anyway, what she did is she went back home and she found a really cozy corner in the house. And she set it up with soft lights. And she got those little beanbag things that the kids could sit on. And then whenever she was trying to teach her children, the little ones, how to be inside and be nice to their feelings and be nice to their body and that kind of thing. And so she set up this little place with this nice soft light and everything. And whenever the kids were having a tantrum or having a hard time or their feelings were just jumping in all different directions, she would take them by the hand and take them over there to the corner and they'd sit down. And she'd listen to them in this caring way and ask them, you know, can you be nice to this? And how does it feel in your body? And that kind of thing. And she said she really knew she had hit pay dirt when the kids would come over and take her by the hand and pull her over to the corner so they could be heard that way. And once you know, it just opens a door. And it opens the kind of door where the communication can really, really be touching in the physical sense, you know, that being heard. And especially with teens, because, I mean, their hormones and everything else are going wacko. and just to be there and know that they can be heard and that someone really hears them in itself is its own miracle.
Yeah, no, these are beautiful examples.
Yeah, I'm amazed. I just hope they keep happening, you know, because they really are helpful when you're trying to teach people.
Yeah.
And especially families. I mean, this is a family thing, and it can be so helpful at all levels, you know, between spouses, and it's just very, very good, you know. To be heard that way and to learn how to listen that mm-hmm. way.
But what's interesting is, you know, as we put this, it's not just in a way a practical thing, a practical skill, because we prefaced this, you know, when you were quoting the bees mm-hmm. and that collective, you know, whole. That psychic whole, so that doing this has that spiritual quality also of a sense of who we are, and doing it and listening in that fashion is a way to experience that we're not isolated, but we're part of this whole.
Exactly. You open a door, and a lot of it depends upon the quality of presence that you have in your family and listening and that kind of thing. But it just opens a door that unfortunately many people never have an opportunity to open.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, when you can bring it into a family, you can bring it into young people's lives. And remember this, that when younger people learn how to focus, they're going to have it for a longer time.
You know? Yeah.
And that's going to make a big, big difference.
Yeah. So, Pete, this sounds like it might be a good place to end, or do you want to say something else to conclude this interview?
I would just, there's just a couple of short things.
Mm-hmm.
And this is more from a scientific point of view. Albert Einstein once admitted that for years before he could come up with his formula, E equals MC squared, he said he had felt this formula in his body for years, but he could not articulate it or write it out that way. And I think this is a perfect example of what Eugene Genlin means by a felt sense. It's a meaning. It's felt in the body. It often cannot be articulated in the kind of cognitive way that we're used to accompanying and talking with one another.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to throw that in. And we do have these words like hunch, intuition, inspiration, revelation. They're trying to get at a kind of knowing that is more than a knowing and analyzing in the mind. And I think these are all different kinds of doors that we can go in through, because people feel in their bodies what's happening around them. And very often they're either afraid of getting in touch with them. I mean, the kids who have used process skipping and the adults who are mired in it in many instances, they just never have a chance. And
mm-hmm.
I think there's a social implication here that's very profound. And I think it's really in our own Western culture, there is that struggle between individuality and solidarity. And how to have a healthy solidarity and a healthy individuality.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, I want to thank you for the opportunity myself just to be able to try to talk about this. It's kind of nice to be on the other end of the able to be invited to do it, because I really feel this is really important for kids, for families, and also The spiritual side of it is barely yet even scratched.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks, Pete.
Okay, well, thank you.
This is part of the Focusing Conversations series of the Focusing Institute, hosted by Serge Prangle. All contents are protected by copyright. You can find other such conversations on our website at focusing.org/conversations.